From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It took us hundreds, thousands of years to figure out what caused an earthquake. In her new book, the science writer Catherine Miles says the Greeks thought they were caused by winds. The Norse thought it was an enormous wolf howling. Da Vinci said an earthquake happened when a collapsing mountain sighed. Today, of course, we understand the mechanics of an earthquake. What scientists still can't do, though, is predict exactly when one will happen. And Miles says, for some reason, that is keeping us from being ready when one does. Because in places like Utah, an earthquake is coming. Today in the program, Catherine Miles is joining us to talk about why we're not really ready for the big one. Join us after the news.
Hey, Radio West listener. We thought you'd want to know that the book we're talking about on today's podcast just happens to be available on Audible. Go to RadioWest.org and you'll find a link included with the show, along with links to IndieBound and Amazon, and any purchases you make through these affiliate partners help support Radio West. Thanks so much.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. If you live somewhere along the Wasatch Front, and most of you do, you know we're due for a big earthquake. Scientists don't know when exactly, but they're pretty sure it's coming. The last big one was 1,400 years ago, and researchers say large earthquakes along the Wasatch Fault come every 1,300 to 1,500 years. So you do the math. And not to scare you too much, but here's a projection of what could happen when it does. The science writer Catherine Miles has looked into this, and she says, expect between 2,000 and 2,500 people to be killed, 9,000 badly injured. The quake itself, she says, would create 20 million tons of debris. More than 80,000 households, about 200,000 people, would be left homeless. In her new book, she asks, where would those families stay? How would we move the bodies, get the injured to hospitals? What about water and gas and sewage lines? A few years ago, the Federal Emergency Management Agency commissioned a report, and it said Utah is not prepared for a major Wasatch Fault earthquake. They even put "not" in caps, not prepared. Salt Lake City was just one of the places Catherine Miles visited when she went around the country exploring what we know about earthquakes, what we think about them, and why we're not ready if and when one hits. Her book is called Quakeland, On the Road to America's Next Devastating Earthquake, and Catherine Miles is joining us to talk about it. Her writing has appeared in Outside Magazine, The New York Times, and The Best American Essay Anthology. She joined us from a studio in Portland, Maine. That's where she's based.
I've always really been interested in the relationships that we form with the natural world, and that's been the basis of all of my work. But the earthquake interest came about by way of my previous book, which was called Superstorm, and it was looking at the 9 days leading up to when Superstorm Sandy made landfall in New York City. And one of the things that most interested me in the research for that book was, first of all, questions of national infrastructure and the way in which our country is and isn't prepared for natural disaster in terms of that infrastructure. And then also first responders and the work that they do in the face of natural disaster, too. So as we were wrapping up that book tour, my editor and I, you know, sort of looked at each other and said, you know, we don't fare so well with hurricanes. How do we do with other natural disasters like earthquakes? And that was quite literally the impetus for this book.
What is it that interests you about the relationship between humans and these natural events? And are we always in – is it a natural biological inclination for us to always be in denial about them?
You know, that's such a good question, and I think about that a lot. I don't know that I have a perfect answer, but one of the things that I do know is that as humans, we tend to consistently underestimate risk, particularly risk in terms of natural disaster. And we see this all the time when we look at, for instance, hurricane evacuation rates. You know, going back to Superstorm Sandy for just a quick second, when people in New York and New Jersey were ordered to evacuate in the face of that storm, over 70% of the people who were ordered order to evacuate chose not to because they just really didn't think it would happen to them. And that's really where we are with earthquakes as well. You know, we haven't as a nation had a major earthquake since 1989, and our collective memory for those sorts of things are really poor. And so as a result, we tend to really sort of either forget that it's a real threat or we tend to minimize the threat, and we tend not to take the sort of precautionary action that would really minimize the damage that something like that would do.
I wonder if it's an adaptive trait that if you live here in Salt Lake City, and a lot of the people listening to this right now don't live so far from the – well, we all do. We live really close to the Wasatch Fault. And just so we don't freak out constantly, we just put it out of our minds.
You know, I wonder about that too, though we do overestimate other risks. Yeah. And so when I was talking to folks at the University of Oregon at the Center for Risk Study, they said, look, you know, if you ask the average American what is the biggest risk they face on any daily basis, they'll tell you that it's a terrorist attack and a nuclear meltdown. And a lot of us live in real fear of that. And those things are actually far less likely than an earthquake. You mentioned the Wasatch Fault. 75% of Utah lives basically in that fault zone.
Yeah.
And I'd be curious to ask how many people there are aware of it. I came to Salt Lake to research the book and went to see the fault. There was a coffee shop built directly on the fault, and I stopped in and just sort of started evangelizing and asking people in the coffee shop if they knew where they were, and no one that I talked to did.
What do you make of that? I mean, I think we know in the back of our minds around here that we're close to a fault, that there's supposed to be a big one coming, but that they couldn't be specific with you about, here it is, right above this or below this coffee shop. What do you make of that?
I think it's because most people there have never experienced an earthquake. It's just not part of their reality. You know, if you live in LA, for instance, you kind of have the opposite effect and you get this sort of eye roll. People say, oh, yeah, earthquakes, because they're thinking of those small, you know, 3.5, 4.0 quakes that they experience there. But, you know, it's been hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years since Salt Lake City has experienced an earthquake. And so I think we lack the imagination to really think about what that would look like.
In the book, you write about how we've always, throughout human history, we've struggled to understand earthquakes. The Greeks thought they were caused by winds. The Aztecs thought it was the devil trying to escape. What do we learn from history about the way we've thought about earthquakes or not thought about earthquakes?
This was one of the really interesting research pieces of this book for me. And I asked seismologists again and again and again about what we do and don't know about earthquakes. And they kept saying the same thing, which is, we don't know anything, really. You know, I mean, we know so little. It is the least known natural disaster, and it's the least known natural phenomenon even. And they came up with all of these analogies that I, you know, talk about in the introduction to the book. We know more about distant galaxies than we know about how our Earth works. We know more about, you know, and they would fill in the blank with something that we know very little about. And, you know, part of it's because it's happening miles and miles and miles underground. And so we see people, you know, as a culture needing to explain a phenomenon that is often a very sort of deadly phenomenon.
Yeah.
I was thinking about this during the eclipse earlier this summer, and I was thinking, you know, if I didn't know what was happening, I could really think that there was something major and maybe sort of metaphysical that was happening here, and I would need to find a way to explain it. And so I think that that's historically what we've done. We don't necessarily do that in terms of collective mythology right now, but we also don't necessarily have a ton of answers or even a fraction of the answers that we really need to understand how this works.
Da Vinci thought that earthquakes happened when collapsing mountains sighed. That's a beautiful. Don't you think it's such a poetic way of thinking about it? It's absurd, of course, but maybe in some ways there's something to it. When did someone actually come up with an actual theory that made some sense?
So it's been a progression, of course.
Yeah.
And, you know, when we start to look at, for instance, the 1700s, 1800s, we start to see some real movement happening in places like England, Ireland, continental Europe. Interestingly, the Jesuits have really led a lot of the research. And when it comes to the history of American seismology, they've really led the way. And our first monitoring stations here in the United States were set up at Jesuit universities. So it's really been sort of a collective effort. The Chinese, not surprisingly, have been trying to at least sort of measure earthquakes for millennia. Obviously, they've had quite a few over there. So it's really been this sort of collective force. But when it comes to things like tectonic plates, you know, that's a phenomenon that we've really only accepted as true scientifically for, you know, a lifetime. Yeah. It's really been the 1960s, 1970s that actually kind of came into fashion as a scientific theory. So when you think about that, that's brand new by scientific standards.
It's interesting how much of the technology about trying to measure, you know, seismic movement came from battlefields and war.
And nuclear power,
and
right?
Nuclear war.
And
exactly. The Cold War is such an interesting sort of chapter in the book.
Yeah, you know, we have this sort of Dr. Strangelove phenomenon to thank for the sort of robust seismic monitoring that we have now. And, you know, it's still happening, right? We knew what was happening in North Korea with some of their nuclear testing because we were measuring it on our seismograms and seismometers. So it's still a very true phenomenon.
What is an earthquake? Like, just thumbnail sketch. What's an earthquake?
Right. So an earthquake is basically, you know, sort of an explosion of pressure, if you will. You have a fault line, right? You have two pieces of either a tectonic plate in some cases, but it can also be an intraplate earthquake. And they're pushing against each other. There's a lot of pressure. And what happens is it reaches sort of a weak place and that pressure, the rock can't sustain that pressure anymore. And so what we see then is that pressure gets released. And it releases, if you can think about, for instance, throwing a pebble into a pond and you think about the rings that radiate out when you do that. That's what's happening with that pressure. There are two waves that seismologists are most interested in. Those waves travel out, and as they travel out, they dissipate, but they also obviously do the damage that we see on the surface.
You tell the story of an earthquake just outside of Yellowstone National Park in the summer of 1959. It's actually a significant part of the book, and we'll come back to this, but this was a 7.5 quake. Say something about the quake, because it just sounds absolutely terrifying.
You know, it's like a Hollywood movie, really, and it's generally known as the Hebgen Lake quake, and it was the last really sort of big quake in that area, and it did a tremendous amount of damage, harrowing stories, and some of the most significant damage came because of a landslide, what might quite possibly be the largest landslide in U.S. history. Mm. And this landslide buried campgrounds. It created a lake where there was no lake. It had hurricane-force winds. We think, about two dozen people under the rubble. That number has never been officially confirmed, unfortunately. And in a lot of ways, this quake is really emblematic, I think, of what any quake would look like. And that's part of why I spend the time with it on the book. It's also just an incredibly compelling and tragic story. I spoke to several survivors of the quake. And what's really noteworthy, I think, for me is not only the physics at play in terms of the damage that this quake did, but the after effects and how hard it was, for instance, for the first responders to get there, how ill-prepared the hospitals were to deal with these kind of almost battle-type injuries that they were seeing. They were seeing gangrene and things like that. Mm. So in a lot of ways, I think it's a really poignant reminder about the damage that these quakes do and just what we have to do to be prepared to confront that damage, both in terms of casualties and also in terms of infrastructure.
Talk about the plates. They make up the outer layer of the Earth's crust, these sort of jagged pieces. We think there are about 15 of these big plates. They're forever in motion. I think we have to understand the way the Earth is built, is constructed. So go through that, if you would, for us.
Sure. So I like to think of the Earth as a peach, if you will. Mm. So we have the core as sort of the pit of that peach. And then we have this very large area that in a lot of ways is kind of like sort of a really juicy, fleshy peach. It's not really liquid. It's not really solid. And unlike a peach, it's in a lot of motion. It kind of recirculates. And then we have this very thin crust on top. You mentioned the plates. They obviously, as they're moving, are capable of very large large earthquakes. If you think about, for instance, the 2011 Japan earthquake, which resulted in the Fukushima nuclear disaster, that was what's called a subduction earthquake, and that where you have one plate sliding under another plate. And those are capable of the biggest earthquakes that we've seen on this planet, the 1964 earthquake in Alaska, a lot of the Chilean earthquakes. The threat of the Cascadia earthquake, something that could create, for instance, a very deadly tsunami in the Pacific Northwest. Those are all subduction earthquakes. You can also just have two plates moving side by side along each other. Also, again, a threat of a very large quake. But we also see these things called intraplate earthquakes. And if you think about, for instance, all of the seismic activity that we've seen in Oklahoma City as a result of fracking and wastewater injection, those are earthquakes that are not happening because two plates are moving. They're happening because there are these other fault lines that happen on a plate. Those are the same sorts of faults that we see in a lot of the Northeast, for instance, New York, Washington, things like that as well. So are they capable of as deadly a quake as, for instance, that 2011 quake in Japan? No. But, you know, you don't need a quake nearly that strong to create a lot of damage and destruction.
You say go to Yellowstone if you want to see the kind of the guts of the planet, because it's kind of exposed right there. Talk a little bit. This seems kind – I have to say this was one of the scariest parts of the book for me, where the park sits on this giant caldera. It's a big sinkhole. And it was created by this kind of mind-blowing, massive volcanic eruption. This is the super volcano. Maybe describe it, if you could, this explosion. I think it was like 2 million years ago. It seems like so big it's hard to describe almost.
It is. It is. And this is part of the tricky work that geologists do, is it's really sort of post-mortem work, right?
Yeah.
They're trying to go back and recreate what happened in some cases millions of years ago, sort of using forensic evidence, really. And some of them are quite sophisticated at doing this. So they can do this work where they're able to look and kind of evaluate and come up with some pretty accurate assessments of seismic activity that happened long before there was human settlement there. So what we have there is what's sort of called a hotspot. And as this plate is sort of moving, it's moving over this sort of firing magma, and it's kind of melting away the plate as it does, if you can think about that. And so the plates in some cases get very thin. Another really great example of this is Hawaii. We have the Hawaiian Islands because of this sort of hot spot phenomenon. And as I sort of joke in the book, if you hang around a few million years, there'll be more Hawaiian Islands for you to visit.
Yeah.
So Yellowstone, same kind of phenomenon. And so what we have is, because we have this very sort of thin layer ultimately, we have those fabulous geysers, sinkholes, mud pots, which I think are fascinating and great. And so it really is, it's the perfect place to get a sense of what's happening underneath our feet.
The amount of this magma underneath Yellowstone, I have to say, is amazing. You say it's 35,000 cubic miles of magma.
I kept trying to come up with an analogy. You know, I kept Googling things like, how many Olympic swimming pools is that? Is it the size of a Great Lake? Is it – because this is, again, like this sort of lack of imagination that,
right.
that certainly I suffer from, and I think maybe some of your listeners do too. It's like, well, how big is that really? Like, how can we picture it? And that's really what I wanted to try to do in the book, was help people picture this really unknown phenomenon. You know, how can we kind of make sense of something we can't see and that we haven't felt, but, you know, may put our lives in jeopardy ultimately?
Yeah. So there's been a lot of activity there, of course, lava flows and quakes and things like that. But this is the thing I wanted you to talk a little bit about, is this idea of a super, not just the super volcano, but a super quake that possibly could be coming. Because the last pressure release, I think I got this right, was something like 70,000 years ago. And so there's this kind of eruptive lull going on. There's this pause, it seems. And I'm wondering if you think we need to be kind of nervous about that.
I don't think we need to be nervous about a super volcano scenario at Yellowstone. And I did pose this to their chief geologist. And, you know, there were a couple of Hollywood movies that came out that sort of suggested that, you know, all of Yellowstone, the top of the volcano was going to be blown off and we were going to see this sort of epic event. And they say, no, not really. You know, we may see some kind of eruptive activity and it would do some damage. You know, it would probably, you know, melt some roads and create some forest fires and certainly do some real damage to Yellowstone, but not, I think, in this sort of like planetary level that some people have speculated about. Now, while that is, you know, probably near impossible, according to them, this sort of super volcano mega explosion, what is entirely possible is a significant earthquake hitting places like Salt Lake City and the Wasatch Fault.
Yeah.
That place is due, you know, and we don't have the precision to say really what due means. We can't say whether that earthquake will happen tomorrow or will happen in 10 years or 100 years. But the potential is there. The return rate is such that it's definitely on the very near horizon. Mm. And so, you know, for emergency managers, for scientists, that's really where they'd like us to focus our attention is not so much on that super volcano scenario. They say, look, yeah, that's dramatic. That's Hollywood. But so is this Wasatch Fault problem. And so is, for instance, the New Madrid Fault problem in Memphis. So is, you know, the possibility of even a moderate quake hitting New York City.
It's Catherine Miles. Her new book is called Quakeland: On the Road to America's Next Devastating Earthquake. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. I'm in KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about earthquakes with the science writer Catherine Miles. In her new book, she reminds us the Wasatch Fault is going to go off, and there's a pretty good chance it will happen in our lifetime. We can't stop it, she says, but we can be prepared for it. The problem is, we're not. Her book is called Quakeland: On the Road to America's Next Devastating Earthquake. Let's talk more about the Wasatch Fault. This brings us to Bob Smith. And I should mention that a good part of the book are these profiles of these various earthquake scientists, a lot of them really fascinating people digging in and trying to understand that. Bob Smith focuses on the Wasatch Fault. And in fact, what was it that you talked about that defined his career?
It was that same Hebgen Lake.
The Hebgen Lake. That's right. Sorry. That's right.
So he was an undergraduate and when the quake happened, and his geology professor took them up and he saw this massive devastation, which was basically, a small mountain that sort of calved off, right? It calved off and created this epic landslide, you know, and again, as I said earlier, quite possibly the largest in American history. And he's just sort of stood there, and there are also these scarps that you can literally go visit there where, for instance, the ground rose. There's a campsite that I start the book with.
Yeah.
And I say, you know, picture this campsite. There's a fire ring next to a picnic table, right? And, you know, this is all American scene that so many of us can picture because we've been there, right? And what you're sitting there, and one minute everything looks perfectly normal and like this typical campsite, and then seconds later that fire pit is now 20 feet higher than the picnic table, and that's because there's this sort of scarp action that's happening because from the pressure released in this earthquake. And so that's what Bob Smith saw literally and thought, you know, wow, what is this thing? And he dedicated his life to studying it, and he's a remarkable person. He's written a really wonderful guide to Yellowstone. He's used Yellowstone for a lot of his research in terms of looking at this sort of rise and fall that's happening in terms of the landscape there. And you're right, he's one of a dozen at least fascinating scientists who were so incredibly generous in giving their time for this book.
He put together this seismic tour. He thinks everyone should go on the seismic tour. And you went.
And I agree. I agree.
Yeah. Talk about this tour. Explain this.
So there are these little medallions that were placed before the age of GIS and GPS. These little medallions were placed by surveyors in Yellowstone so that they could do the surveying work. And what's really interesting is this is part of the national park history. So Yellowstone, this kind of experiment in national parks, by some people's thinking, if you live in LA or New York, for instance, in the middle of nowhere, so we create this national park a long way away from a lot of major population centers. And so there was this question, would anybody visit? Yeah. And lo and behold, all kinds of people wanted to visit, and rightfully so. And so what was a very sort of rudimentary road system there quickly proved insufficient. And so the National Park Service mounted this fairly massive road construction project, and the surveying happened as a result. So these surveying medallions exist there. And as the volcano sort of becomes active, becomes dormant, has this sort of kind of natural ebb and flow of its activity, the land in and around Yellowstone rises and falls. If you kind of think of it almost as sort of, to kind of borrow that sort of poetry from earlier, it's almost like it's breathing, right?
Yeah.
And so that rise and fall of the lungs almost. And so as it's rising and falling, Smith and other scientists can chart it using these medallions. And he used that as the basis of his guide. And I'll put a quick plug in it. It's just out in a new edition, I think, as of this summer. And it's really remarkable. And it's like I said, it's just a great way to understand our planet in a way that so few of us really do.
But Smith says that most volcanoes tend to grow just before they erupt, which led me to think, well, if we are tracking this, the rises and the falls of all of this stuff, if we're seeing it rise, does that not tell us that an earthquake might be coming?
Might, right? Yeah, and that's the real question is might. And that's what there are so many very smart people, geophysicists, seismologists, who are out there and they've dedicated their life to this question of might, right? So, for instance, if there are a series of small quakes, will they lead to a big quake? Are they precursory? Are they foreshocks or are they just little quakes? Is that rise at Yellowstone, is it signifying a large earthquake or a volcanic eruption, or is it part of the sort of normal rise and subsidence that we see?
Yeah.
And right now, this is that unknowability. We don't know which small quake is going to lead to the big quake. There was some movement on that front during the last big Chilean earthquake. Two seismologists who are based at UC Santa Cruz, they were looking at that those small quakes in Chile in the days beforehand, and they said, look, we think this is what they call precursory action. We think these small quakes are really just sort of heralding this large quake, and they were right. The problem is that we don't have 100% accuracy with that yet. The same thing with this rise and this uplift and this subsidence. But you're right, especially when we see a fairly rapid and dramatic uplift, that's a good indication that there might be some seismic activity, volcanic activity to come.
There's a scientist at the Yellowstone Volcano Observatory named Jake Lowenstern. And something that he said that you quote in the book helped me kind of think about the way we think or don't think about the possibility of something like an earthquake. And I want to read what he says here. He says, if you're a mayfly, you're around for a day. You mate, you die. Do you believe that there is such a thing as a snowstorm or skyscrapers? That's stuff that you're never going to experience. And he says, humans are like that with respect to the process of Earth. If you think of geological time, we're barely a blip. I guess what he's getting at is it makes it difficult for us to even conceive of the possibilities in some way.
I love that quote so much, and I think it's really, really true. And when it comes to things like disaster preparedness, going back to something that you were saying earlier, I really think it comes to this idea of sort of what we think is possible. And so as a result, what are we willing to do? And this is really this idea of sort of hazard versus risk, right? So the hazard rates for earthquakes around the country are very different, right? The hazard rate of an earthquake happening, for instance, Anchorage, pretty high, right? Comparatively speaking. The hazard of it happening in New York City, definitely lower than Anchorage, without a doubt. But the risk of that earthquake in New York City is exponentially more, right? Because it doesn't have the same building codes, because it has this huge population center, because it has so much infrastructure there. And so I think that we're misguided if we only think about earthquakes in terms of hazards.
Yeah.
And it's worth noting that these hazards are constantly changing, right? I mentioned Oklahoma earlier, this idea of induced seismicity, which is happening all the time and more frequently. You know, we're setting off earthquakes with reservoirs and mining and dam building and even, you know, high-rise construction, let alone things like, you know, wastewater injection and fracking. And so we're literally changing earthquake hazard around the country as well, too. And these are all just reminders of why we need to be shoring up both our sort of, you know, our homes and our emergency plans as individuals and also as communities.
We get a D in terms of our infrastructure, at least from civil engineers in this country. And I wanted you to maybe compare that with other developed countries. Where do we situate ourselves in terms of being prepared in terms of the infrastructure?
Yeah, this is such a great question. And the unfortunate answer is we don't look very good. You know, I sort of flippantly like to joke that, you know, if an undergraduate at a college got a D, right, that person would lose their scholarship and be placed on academic probation and probably be grounded at home, right? and that's where we've been for quite some time. And as a country, you know, we're dealing with incredibly outmoded infrastructure, and it's really starting to catch up with us in a variety of different ways. If you look at, for instance, all of the hurricane activity that's happening right now, part of why places are going to be out of power for so long is that we continue to rely on this 19th century mode of delivering electricity, right, which is these dangling lines on these wooden posts, you know? I mean, we've been doing that since the 1900s, and we haven't really changed it much, you know? So then we also have these other infrastructures. Our levee system is actually one of the most fragile and most vulnerable when it comes to seismic activity. And as I say in the book, the overwhelming majority of Americans live within the range of a levee. Then we look at things like our bridges, our, you know, our dams, our roads, our airports. We just have not, as a country, invested in that. And equally as important, if I may say, is this sort of metaphoric infrastructure, which we also have not invested in. So if you look at Mexico, for instance, and the deadly quakes that happened there in the past, you know, few weeks, those would have been a lot more deadly had Mexico not, for instance, had an early warning system,
yeah,
which they've had in place since the very catastrophic 1985 earthquake. It was the first national early warning system on the planet, and it's been one that's been appropriated and taken up and improved upon and developed by other countries, Taiwan, some Eastern European countries, Japan. We have the technology in place right now to have a national early warning system. We haven't funded it at the congressional level. And so as a result, you know, we don't have it. We haven't funded our infrastructure. And if you look at, for instance, President Trump's infrastructure bill that he introduced in June and that Congress is currently considering, it's actually you know, going to worsen, if I may say, the problem of infrastructure in the country. And so it really is about this question of where do we want to invest? Do we want to invest on the front end before an earthquake or another natural disaster happens? Or do we want to invest in the cleanup and the reparation and the attempt to get communities back online after a disaster has struck?
I want to ask about this warning system, because it's so interesting that even though we concede we can't give much of a warning, like 90 seconds, maybe 2 minutes. But that is, I guess what you're saying is that's better than nothing. And in some ways, it can be quite significant, that just that 2 minute warning.
Life-saving.
Yeah.
In the book, I traveled to the University of California at Berkeley, where a lot of this work is being done in conjunction with some other universities in the USGS out there. And I posed this question because I thought, you know, what am I going to do with 45 seconds?
Right.
I can't do anything with 45 seconds. And I posed this to some of the scientists there, and they said, you know, hey, look, watch, right? And I talk about this in the book. And it is amazing if you sort of count it out for yourself what you can get done. In 45 seconds, you can get out of bed.
Mm-hmm.
You can get your son or daughter out of the next room. You can grab your go bag and you can get under the dining room table. And that, at an individual level, could very well mean the difference between life and death. It's enough time for an air traffic control tower to redirect a plane that's about to land. It's enough time for BART, the mass transit system in San Francisco, to stop its buses, stop its trains, close a tunnel. And so those seconds really do do make a huge difference. And they're part of why we need it on a national level. Earthquakes are not a California problem. They're not just a West Coast problem. They really are a national problem.
You also raised the question of what would the consequences be or the impact if, let's say, the warning system gets it wrong. Do they begin to lose their impact? Some scientists, Jen Strauss is one that you talk to, I guess they worry a little bit about that. Is that a problem?
This is a fine line. And you know, going back to Mexico again, another thing that Mexico did after that 1985 earthquake is it instituted a national drill program. And so every year on the anniversary of that quake, the entire country stops what it's doing and it has an earthquake drill. And they were literally doing that the day of the earthquake. And because they were doing that work, because they were drilling, people knew what to do. You know, kids knew how to take cover in their classrooms calmly because they had done it before. People knew how to evacuate their houses. They knew not to stand under power lines, those sorts of things. So there is something that is helpful and healthy in terms of drilling about that. And to a certain degree, a few sort of crying wolf type situations of sort of misfired warnings would really just sort of help us with that, right? We would we would drill.
Yeah.
But it's a fine line, as you say, right? If it's inaccurate, then people are going to not believe it anymore. But you know, this system is in beta and is being used in California right now on a beta level. And it works. It works with amazing accuracy. And the technology is in place to have it very robustly established throughout the West Coast. With some more seismometers around the country, we could definitely have it at the national level. Another thing that's really fascinating to me is the work that they're doing in terms of crowdsourced early warning systems. And every smartphone has a device in it. It knows whether your phone's upside down or right side up. And it also can measure an earthquake. And it can distinguish an earthquake from you jostling it around or dropping it or shaking it. And so another development that they're working on right now is using this crowdsourced, anonymized information from smartphones around the world to get information about earthquake activity, especially in places where we don't have a lot of seismometers. And then in turn, what they get back is this early warning system. And so that's the kind of thinking, I think, that's really going to get us closer to where we need to be in terms of preparedness.
Let's come back to the basin and range and the Wasatch Fault. Because as you explained it in the book, it's the most lethal of the faults. And there are good deal of them in the basin and range area. Wasatch Fault, you describe, it's a 240-mile loaded fracture, runs from central Utah into Idaho. And of course, those of us who live around here know that Salt Lake City was built basically right on top of it. And there's a great letter to the editor, to the Salt Lake Daily Tribune from 1883, which is kind of gives us kind of a warning from the 1800s. Would you say something about that? This is really funny. Great, actually.
Yeah, you know, there was this awareness very early on that Salt Lake was not only built in a very seismically active zone, one of the most seismically active in the country, but that it wasn't ready for the resulting earthquake. And it was this letter of warning. It's interesting. I kind of pair that letter to the editor in Salt Lake with a similar op-ed that appeared in the New York Times. After right around the same time period, actually, I think even the same decade, the 1880s.
Yeah.
And there had been an earthquake, a moderate earthquake in New York. And the editors at the New York Times kind of just poo-poo it. And they're like, oh, pshaw. This will never happen again in New York, and you're being an alarmist and ridiculous if you even think that this is a concern. So two very different responses to the same basic phenomenon. You know, and Salt Lake is tricky, like a lot of areas too, because in addition to this potential for seismic activity, you also have a lot of really potentially unstable soil. Mm-hmm. And there's a phenomenon known as liquefaction, where because of this shaking and this jostling, the soil starts to act like a liquid. And when you see that happening, you start to see really immense destruction to built structures.
Well, that's one of the things that those of us who live around here are reminded of, is that Mexico City was also built on an ancient lake bed. So I wonder, can we look and see what happened there to imagine what could happen here?
To some degree, yes. I mean, there are obviously a lot of different variables. There are, you know, different building codes, things like that. But yeah, I don't think that's an unreasonable comparison to make. And in the book, I sort of outline the scenario of what would happen were this, say, 7.0 earthquake to happen in Salt Lake City, and how much rubble would be created. How long would it be before people had electricity, before people had power. I don't think making an analogy between, for instance, Puerto Rico right now and Salt Lake City is necessarily wrong either. I think the same sorts of problems is what we're going to see. People who don't have access to clean drinking water, people who don't have access to electricity. And so as a result, we start to see these secondary problems, diabetics who can't get their insulin, people who are on breathing machines, those sorts of problems that start to crop up when we don't have access to things like electricity, food and water.
It's Catherine Miles. Her new book is called Quakeland: On the Road to America's Next Devastating Earthquake. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the science writer Catherine Miles. We're talking about her new book. It's called Quakeland: On the Road to America's Next Devastating Earthquake. I want to talk a little bit about the psychological traumatic impacts of an earthquake, which you explore with the Painter family, Myrtle Painter and their twin daughters. Let's go back to August of 1959. And talk a little bit more about that earthquake, which was remarkable, kind of terrifying. It's interesting. You say the energy dropped the basin of a lake up there, like 22 feet in places, caused this surge that sounds something like a tsunami almost.
It really does sound like a tsunami. And I spoke to the painters who were incredibly gracious in telling their story. And, this 1959 Hebgen Lake earthquake and the damage that it did, the three daughters were quite young at the time, and they lost their mother in the earthquake. She eventually died of her injuries. And they tell the story in just harrowing detail. And you know, this after effect, one of the things that's really interesting in terms of emerging fields in psychology is looking at natural disaster trauma research and the way in which we all respond to natural disaster trauma. And one of the findings is that for a variety of reasons, we have a particularly hard time responding to earthquakes. And what psychologists in this field speculate about is that it's that unknowability. It's that surprise factor, for starters. So whereas we may get, for instance, a day or two warning about a hurricane coming, We get no warning here in the United States that an earthquake's about to happen. And so that surprise factor is really significant. I think the other thing that's really significant is if you take an example like a hurricane or a tornado, it's almost this entity, right? It's almost like I think about Jaws, for instance, right? Like there's this menacing force that's in the ocean, right? Yeah. And I think we can do that with a hurricane or a tornado. We can kind of make it into an entity that's kind of like this monster kind of out to get us. But we can't do that with an earthquake. It's literally our planet doing this. And it's what we think of as stable. I mean, if you think about our metaphors, we think, you know, when we talk about foundation or bedrock or what is solid, you know, solid earth and things like that, it all goes back to this sort of fundamental belief we have that the ground beneath our feet is going to stay solid and not move and support us when we need to. You know, and I think a lot of our existence is sort of based on that. And so when that doesn't happen, when we have this sort of surprise attack and it's from our very, you know, the very ground beneath our feet, that really messes with us. And, you know, the PTSD rates from earthquake survivors are significant. And the amount of, for instance, depression, violence, suicide that comes about as a result is something that we really haven't talked about. We tend to think, you know, people survive. We get them out of the rubble. We give them some clean clothes and some water, and we send them on their way. And they're survivors, and they are survivors. But they also have this trauma that sometimes we don't know to treat, and the residual effects of that, as well as, for instance, the residual effects of displacement. Yeah. We're starting to really see that in areas in Japan right now after Fukushima. You know, people who have been removed from their homes and what that means in terms of our sense of dislocation and identity.
It's interesting. You also write that there's a kind of strange physiological thing that happens when you experience an earthquake. It messes up our equilibrium or something in our inner ear almost.
Yeah, we don't know a lot about this yet. We know that it happens. And the best analogy that I can make for this is if you've ever been at sea or even on, you know, say, a carnival ride for a while. You know, if you've gone sailing, for instance, and you step off the boat and you step onto the dock and now all of a sudden the land is swaying like the sea was. It's a similar sort of effect where the inner ear tries to make sense of motion to give us that sense of equilibrium. And so, you know, if you kind of think of it as trying to sort of swing in concert with the motion around you, and then when you sort of step away from that motion or that motion stops, it takes the inner ear a while to recover. And so it still is kind of swaying around.
I wanted to ask you about these core samples from this deep sea drilling expedition and what these cores can tell us about earthquakes. Would you spend a few moments with that?
Sure. So, you know, so much of this is happening, as I said earlier, miles and miles and miles underground. So how do you see it? How do you know? And there have been a variety of attempts to kind of literally get down there, you know, kind of journey into the middle of the earth, as it were. And we have had one very successful attempt to kind of drill down into a fault, which is different than, say, wanting to drill down into the mantle of the earth, which was the original project and something we haven't yet figured out how to do. But there was a really remarkable project that happened on the San Andreas Fault where they were able to drill into the fault itself and then pull out these core samples and use them to study. It's very similar to the core samples that were taken from the seafloor, which ultimately was what proved the plate tectonic theory, is they could prove that this new material was being created all of the time. And so as you got closer and closer and closer to these giant trenches under the ocean, the seafloor literally got younger and younger and younger. So there's a very fascinating cold storage warehouse, if you will, in Texas, and those core samples are there too. And they for seismic research, they really are the holy grail.
I want to ask you about. So there was this interesting story that plays out in Italy in 2008. There is Giampaolo Giuliani, I guess is his name. He's a scientist who makes this projection, starts giving out these earthquake warnings. And it's an interesting story because some Italian officials didn't like the fact that he was doing this. And so would you tell this story? Because I think it's instructive.
Sure, sure. So there's been a variety of ways to try to predict earthquakes throughout human history and even just in very recent times. Some people have looked at, for instance, the behavior of animals and have suggested that animals have this sort of sixth sense or this ability to either intuit or sense an earthquake before it happens. And so certainly anecdotal evidence of that. You know, people have told stories that, you know, their dog and cat woke up, you know, moments before an earthquake happened. And other people have looked at things like radon levels, and that's actually what he was doing. And, and so he felt like he had enough evidence to sort of say, I can predict that an earthquake is going to happen. He presented that information to the Italian authorities, who were mixed in terms of their response to that. But ultimately, what did happen in this situation is that there was an earthquake in Italy. And what was really interesting to me from sort of an anthropological and sociological perspective is after this earthquake, you know, there was a seismology meeting that was happening at the time. Folks got together. They looked at it. They ultimately decided, you know, as most seismologists do, that they cannot yet accurately predict an earthquake based on sort of small earthquake behavior that's happening beforehand. Yeah. And so that was their position. It's like, look, we can't do this. We've tried to do it. We've failed. And so when the earthquake happened, they were actually brought up on manslaughter charges. Yeah. And that really incensed the scientific community around the world. They said, look, you know, they're scientists. You know, they can't do this without enough sort of evidence to sort of make, you know, a reasonable claim. And they didn't have it. Nobody ever has it. Yeah. But this idea of sort of needing to blame someone, I think, is really interesting.
One of the lessons, it seems, from that story is that rather than try and predict earthquakes, just know that they're probably coming and plan for the worst?
Within reason, yeah, right? And so that's where this idea of hazard and risk comes in.
Yeah.
You know, if you live in Miami, for instance, probably, you know, seismically retrofitting your house is not going to be the best use of your money. Probably, you know, hurricane shutters are going to be a better idea.
Yeah.
But yes, absolutely. At a community level, we should be doing this. And you know, that's true in places like Memphis and the Mississippi Valley. It's true in places like New York. It's true in places like Salt Lake City. And what seismologists say again and again and again is, look, you know, there's going to be an earthquake there.
Yeah.
We just don't know when.
Right.
And so because we don't know when, let's take reasonable, affordable, you know, measured measures, I guess, to,
yeah,
you know, to really kind of be prepared for that. And it's not really it's not about being shrill. It's not about sort of trying to be overly dramatic. It's saying, listen, like, there are some really basic things we can do here. You know, as homeowners, you know, or renters or whomever, we can bracket our bookcases mm-hmm. to a wall. That takes an afternoon. You know, as a family, we can have a disaster management plan of our own. What we know about these earthquakes is, you know, if a significant one happens, it's probably going to knock out cell service. It's probably going to knock out electricity. And so if you can't communicate with your family members, how are you going to meet up? Do you have a place where you can meet up? Do you have enough food and water that you can take care of yourself for, say, a week until the first responders can come get to you? So those sorts of questions, understanding that a lot of death and destruction that happens as a result of an earthquake is not actually the tremor itself, but resulting fires.
Yeah.
And so these are the sorts of things that I outline in the book. Again, not because I want to be sensational, but because the threat is real, and because we can manage this threat in a reasonable and responsible way and ultimately become more resilient as communities, whether or not the earthquake strikes.
You're calling for a new paradigm, a sustainable plan.
A sustainable plan. And isn't that a good idea for everything, really?
Yeah, right. Yeah, absolutely. Let me ask you this. If and I'm sure you put this question to him, and maybe not quite in this way, but if you were to say, ask Bob Smith in Utah, when he figured, maybe this is an annoying question given that we've just spent an hour talking about how complicated all of this is, but if you ask Bob Smith when he figures the big one or one of the big ones that we expect for the Wasatch Fault is coming, what does he say? What's his answer?
Yeah, and I definitely won't try to put words in Bob Smith's mouth, but I will say is I did pose this question to all sorts of, again, you know, first responders, emergency managers, seismologists, and they say, look, you know, first of all, we don't know,
yeah,
you know, and second of all, it doesn't really matter. You know,
yeah,
it doesn't really matter because the things that we're going to need to do to prepare for it, we just need to do them anyway. You know, and so let's look at things like retrofitting. Let's look at strengthening up our national building code so that buildings not only allow you to evacuate them safely, but they can also be re-inhabited afterwards. Mm-hmm. Let's go ahead and, again, have those emergency management plans, have those contingency plans in place so that if and when it does occur, we know what to do. And if you think about this, think about schools. You know, they drill. They have fire drills. You know, where I come from, they have tornado drills. You know, coming in from the Midwest where there's the New Madrid Fault, you know, we started doing earthquake drills when I was in middle school, and that persists today because they decided that threat was real. So take a look at it. You know, you can still sleep through the night, but maybe you'll even sleep better through the night because you know that you've got a duffel bag that has food and water and medical supplies on it. And you know that if your kid's at school and cell phone goes out, that you all are going to meet at the flagpole. And so maybe that assuredness actually is going to be that much more sort of rewarding and ultimately that much more sort of placating in terms of how we feel.
It's Catherine Miles. Her book is called Quakeland: On the Road to America's Next Devastating Earthquake. She joined us from a studio in Portland, Maine. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We had technical direction from Tim Slover. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.